The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to call this meeting to order. Before we begin, I would ask you to make sure your cell phones are turned off or put on silent. And I would like to begin with introductions, starting with Mr. McGuire.
Brendan McGuire, MLA for Halifax Atlantic.
I'm Terry Farrell, the MLA for Cumberland North.
Bill Horn, member for Waverley Fall River Beaver Bank.
Joachim Stroink, member for Halifax Shabucto.
Ian Rankin, Timberley Prospect.
Good morning. My name is Tim Houston. I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning. Maureen McDonald, Halifax Needham.
Morning. Dave Wilson, Sackville-Cobequid.
My name is Alan McMaster. I'm your chair. And today we have with us the Department of Economic and Rural Development. And please introduce yourselves.
Simon D'Entremont, Deputy Minister.
Lalani Kumaranayake, Executive Director, Policy and Planning.
Jeff Larson, Executive Director, Investment and Trade.
Good morning. Wayne Samara, Executive Director, Productivity and Innovation Branch.
Thank you. And today we have an examination of funding programs at the Department. Before we begin with your introduction of your introductory remarks, the remainder of the meeting we will have a discussion on a proposal from the Auditor General dated May 30th and May 17th. We will discuss that after this meeting. Followed by a briefing for next week's meeting. And with that, I would ask the Department, Mr. D'Entremont, if you would like to begin with an introduction.
I would. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, thank you, and good morning to committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our progress on the Auditor General's recommendations on our funding programs. We've already been introduced to my colleagues who joined me today, Jeff Larson, Wayne Samara, and Lalani Kumaranayake. Our department and the six agencies that report to our minister have an important mandate to achieve on behalf of Nova Scotians, and that is to support the growth of the economy and the creation of jobs throughout the province. Over the past few years, the department has undergone significant change. We've introduced several new programs, modified and grown others, and expanded into new areas of focus. Each year, our department receives about 3,000 applications and manages in the region of 1,700 to 2,000 transactions to provide support to businesses, nonprofit, and community organizations through a wide range of programs. Today, ERDT offers about 28 individual funding programs, from co-op programs for summer students to those designed to support innovation and trade. Each program has a different goal, criteria, and administrative process. And last year, the Auditor General's Office examined 10 of these programs, including a sample of large investments from the Nova Scotia Jobs Fund. The Auditor General's Office came at a time when we were already working to improve and strengthen our processes, and we continue to do so as part of our business. We've implemented or are well on our way to implementing nearly all of the past and present recommendations. Mr. Chair, the Department has accepted the recommendations, and we take them very seriously. The senior management team and I feel that they provide a good pathway to strengthen our controls, processes, and monitoring systems, improve the program's overall and records management practices, and advance the kind of accountability and transparency that Nova Scotians are looking for, all things we want to achieve. Other work continues. For example, we're working with the Internal Audit Center to implement a comprehensive monitoring system for all funding programs. The department has hired a new investment funds manager to oversee processes and compliance related to the Jobs Fund. Staff are updating and consistently using our checklists to better evaluate and monitor our investments. Better records management is a key part of that. Jobs Fund processes are also further being reviewed, and the fund's process guide is being updated to reflect new controls and procedures. We're developing and refining a performance framework to make sure goals for our programs are specific and measurable. I'd now like to talk briefly about the process and due diligence we undertake to assess and approve funding. For many of these programs, applications are approved within the department using established criteria and guidelines. Where we need to seek direction and approval from the elected government, our job is to thoroughly assess requests, consider and understand the risks so that we can provide options and advice to the decision makers. An example of this, where we do this, is under the Nova Scotia Jobs Fund. Its mandate under the Act was established to accomplish both economic and social goals. Because of the complexity, size, and nature of these transactions, we seek direction and approval from the government of the day, and we follow an established process for new funding. Staff evaluate a company's request and perform due diligence. They may work through my office to seek direction and set parameters. With the financial and economic analysis complete, options are presented to the independent Jobs Fund Board for advice to the minister. Staff pull all the information together for the minister, who decides whether to bring a transaction to Executive Council for consideration. Once the package leaves the department, it's further reviewed by staff at Treasury Board for a staff assessment and recommendation for Executive Council. Often these packages are accompanied by verbal briefings which help government make well-informed decisions. During the period reviewed by the Auditor General, these transactions also went to Economic Investment Committee of Executive Council. There are lots of checks and balances in the process, and these are being strengthened. We're committed to continuously improving the administration of all our programs. The Auditor General's recommendations are and will continue to contribute significantly to this work. Thank you. My colleagues and I are prepared to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. D'Entremont. We will turn to Mr. Houston for 20 minutes.
Next person over. Thank you, Mr. D'Entremont. I appreciate that intro. Just a couple questions just to orientate myself before we get started here. So what would you say is the total average capital that was invested over the years 2011, 2012, and 2013 by your departments?
The invested capital over those years, we would probably have been in a range over that three-year period of, I hate to take a guess here, I wouldn't know the exact number, but it would be $500 or $600 million.
So $500 or $600 million?
Okay. Yes.
And during that period of time, there would have been write-offs of some investments? Would you be able to?
That's part of our business, is to take reserves against loans if we believe that that they're required. There's not a direct impact, actually, when we give out loans on the operating budget of the province, unless we give out grants, forgive loans, or actually take those types of write-offs. Our rate of loss on loans under our investments under the Jobs Fund and its predecessor, the Industrial Expansion Fund, are less than 5% over the last 10 years.
Okay. And just the final question in that series is, how many staff would you say are in the department?
The department has around 250 to 270 staff. That includes a number of staff who work in visitor information centres, the tourist bureaus, on a part-time basis. So the number of staff, we have a number of staff who are part-time.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks very much. Now, the Auditor General's report, he points to a number of guidelines that are not being followed. And I know in your introductory comments, you said for many of these programs, applications are approved within the department using established criteria and guidelines. So I understood you to say there's about 28 programs.
That's correct.
And for many of those 28, applications are processed using established guidelines. Can you give me a sense as to?
We have some of our programs that are very eligibility-based, that if you send an application, you're eligible for the program. You can kind of easily get through the approval process. Others require more judgment of staff to find out whether or not we're meeting eligibility guidelines. The criteria of the program that we had, we all have criteria for our programs, but some of them needed to be more measurable, and that's something we're actively working on, making sure that we have measurable. Because what we're trying to do as part of the follow-up to the Auditor General's recommendations that's really going to help the department a lot is to develop an overall monitoring program. Mm-hmm. The monitoring program, to do that, we need to know what the measurable goals of the programs are. That way, when we implement the monitoring program, we know what we're measuring against. So we're making some good progress there, and we're going through all of our programs to make sure that goals are measurable, specific, and that guidelines for eligibility are clear for staff, and that we take out any ambiguity.
Okay. So now in terms of the guidelines, so presumably there's operating manuals, I guess, is that if you get this type of application for this program, you are to follow these particular guidelines.
Yes.
So would there be a number of different guideline manuals?
Yeah, the programs are quite diverse within the department. Of the 28 programs that we have a number of co-op programs to support summer employment, for example, for students, or to attach science graduates or recent graduates from university into work terms. Those would have different eligibility criteria and guidelines than, for example, our programs to support companies, small business for doing trade, finding new markets. Again, which would be different from our programs whereby we would be looking to provide assistance to companies to expand their operations or to support communities with community infrastructure.
Great. Okay, thanks very much. So there's a lot of talk I hear about over $300 million. Maybe I think the Auditor General maybe said $323 million that was given out without financial analysis. So I know your guidelines are always changing and you're trying to improve them at all times, presumably. And I think you've moved to a portfolio approach for performance reviews of investments. So you're actively monitoring financial performance of the investee companies at the moment. But I guess maybe if you can talk for a little bit about how are you assessing these current day performance reviews on investments where there might not have been any analysis done with to begin with?
Sure, I can maybe pass it on to Jeff in a few minutes. When applications come in, we assess them for financial viability. We do a challenge function against the quality of the assumptions. For some companies, we may have gone online. We have some publicly traded companies. We may have gone online to look at financial statements online. If we don't print them off, put them in the file, make a record that we did that analysis, and that analysis doesn't show in the file. Of course, a good practice which we need to improve is to make sure that we demonstrate that we've undertaken that due diligence and make a note of it in the file so when the Auditor General and others come to make sure that we're accountable in the work that we do, we can demonstrate that that's the case. So we've established a process guide and checklist to make sure that in the future, as we go through, we can ensure that we don't miss those important steps or we make sure that we document them in the file rather than... We have very talented staff who do a very good job with their very analytic skills to be able to do the type of analysis that reduces risk for the province, but unless we take some steps to make sure that we document those in the file. We also have some models whereby we can measure economic benefit in terms of taxation benefits for the province from employee payroll, as well as other types of spin-off benefits, depending on the type of investment. Sometimes the investment might be related to employment creation. Sometimes we may be looking to support a certain sector that needs some help. So I'll maybe pass it over to Jeff.
Well, no, that's actually, I'm okay with that, yeah.
Okay.
But you did say something there that kind of tweaked my interest, and that is it's all about reducing economic risk to the province. So is there any situations or any circumstances where you've made an investment or you've given a company some money where there's an opportunity to claw some of that back or take some action?
Can you elaborate on the question?
Well, I'm just wondering if you do the subsequent analysis, presumably those subsequent analysis are all part of determining your write-off.
Right.
But is there any time where a subsequent analysis would point to, well, hold on a second, this company didn't do what it said it was going to do, or this happened, or that happened, so therefore they owe money back to the province? Or
absolutely.
Is the analysis basically for bad debt provisions?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, in our letters of offer, we have conditions that dictate the types of terms that companies need to meet in order either to earn forgiveness, if that was the term of the loan, or to make sure we meet disbursements. We have mechanisms whereby we go through and make sure that we meet those terms and conditions of our agreements before we undertake those steps. That's something we need to continue to be very rigorous, to continue to improve. We've got some room for improvement there. But we do have those mechanisms in the letters of offer, that there are terms and conditions that need to be met by the companies to keep up their end of the bargain in order for us to continue to do business as well.
So have there been any examples over, maybe, let's say, the past 2 years where you've been able to recover money that had been previously given out as a result of doing this type of analysis?
I'm going to turn that one over to Jeff, maybe, who might have some more examples.
I think BlackBerry is an example where an incentive was created for them to continue operations in Bedford, and when it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, the incentive was returned to the province.
Okay. Now, during the election campaign, the now government campaign that it was going to approve accountability for government loans to businesses, and they stated in their platform that this would save taxpayers $10 million. I'm just wondering, in the last 4 months, have you had any meetings with the minister or anyone who gave you any directive to improve accountability?
Yes, I'm going to hand it over to Lonnie, who can maybe explain the new Accountability Act and the processes we're putting in place to improve transparency and accountability.
Ms. Kumaranayake.
So in November, the department was provided direction by the minister to draft a new Accountability Act that was actually passed in the legislature in December. The Accountability Act will become into effect legally April 1st, and currently we're in the process of developing the regulations. So that really will set the guidelines for what's being reported. In terms of the what will appear on a website April 1st will be transactions back to October 22nd when the government was sworn in. So the mechanisms are now being set up in place to both set up the sort of templates for reporting but also create the website, so it's in effect when the Act comes into force on April 1st.
Right. So the main feature of the Accountability Act is putting transactions on a website. Can you make the connection between a website and saving $10 million to me? I'm just wondering if you've had actual discussions about how this will save taxpayers $10 million, a very specific number. I'm wondering how a website can save that, or what am I missing there?
I don't want to speculate on behalf of the government, but they have decided on a different approach on how to do economic development. They want to have a different view of how we provide assistance to business. It may be that this different approach to assistance to business will provide an opportunity to spend less on, make fewer expenditures on assistance to business.
Okay. So there hasn't been actual discussion with your department of let's find a way to save $10 million. Guys, how can you help me do that? That's kind of not a number that's been discuss specifically with you, I guess.
We have started some discussions within the department to try to ascertain how we can make sure we align our budget with the platform and commitments of the government.
Okay. So the now government has also, you know, been pretty vocal on its promises to end bailouts, and its plans to ensure that the province becomes a lender of last resort. So I'm just wondering, what does the term bailout mean to you?
That can be interpreted in many ways, but in the provision of assistance to business, many Nova Scotians do feel the provision of assistance from government to business is an expense that they may or may not support, and it's the decision of government on how they want to make those types of investments. We, as a civil service, we provide advice and options to government for them to decide how to make policy and how to do economic development. We help them achieve that. We support the government of the day in delivering their economic agenda as they see fit.
Would you consider the investment in Port Hawkesbury paper to be a bailout? Would you, you personally?
I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on government's policy. We provide advice to government to help them make the best decisions that they can make. At the end of the day, those are their decisions. And by doing so, they establish government policy. They just, whether or not government is prepared to save a one-industry town by investing in a major employer is making government policy on community development, social development, and regional issues. And we, our job is to help provide advice to help governments make the best decisions that they can.
So I'm just looking at some of the stuff. So what, the Auditor General... seven projects that he tested, totaling over $800,000. He didn't find that any of those met the eligibility requirements. No financial analysis really supporting those disbursements. So in your role as providing advice to the government, do you sometimes find yourself in situations that you're making recommendations without financial advice? Backing those up, or how does, I'm just trying to get my head around how that happens, that money is dispersed with very little or in some cases no backup.
Sure. Strategic Funding Initiatives, which is the program in question, is a program that was established within the department to provide some flexibility for those types of projects that were thought to be worthwhile to invest in but didn't meet the criteria of our other suites of programs. These types of projects are often very community-based. They're from organizations who don't have strong financial means. We funded projects like Hope Blooms, which is a community garden run by youth in the city who make salad dressings and have been on Dragon's Den, you may have seen. We funded the Apple Blossom Festival, cultural and tourism infrastructure. These types of investments, often those investments were very closer to the community development side of the business. And we have this program which allowed the minister to make a decision to invest in those types of investments should the minister see fit. We made a decision to move the program to communities, culture, and heritage last year. It came about as part of our work with regional development authorities, where with regional development authorities, we had been talking with them about how to establish regional enterprise networks to replace them. And many communities expressed concerns that if we were going to focus more on business development and less on community development, who would do the community development? Because in many communities, the community development is very important. So what we did, we took that program that we thought was very closer akin to the programs of CCH around community development, and we transferred it there. That way, we can create a little bit better separation between us and communities, culture, and heritage in terms of who does what part of the business. So we're having ongoing discussions with CCH to try to establish a little bit more clarity for communities that when they want to do economic development, they approach us. When they want to do community development, they can approach CCH. And we gave them a program to actually help them implement that separation.
Okay. So in specific, under specific programs, it would be your position that there really wouldn't be any need for any financial analysis to support a decision because there's other factors.
There may be other factors. Some of the programs that are more designed around the community development piece, maybe the measurement of tax revenue from employment might be less important than in other programs. But it's really program by program. But good due diligence and good analysis of what the benefits are. Maybe some of the benefits may be more social. They may be more regional. Sometimes they're more economic. The more economic end of the spectrum that we work, the more analysis that we do on the economic benefits. Where there are community benefits, it's a bit harder to quantify how to measure those. And we need, that's something where we actually need to improve on within the department, is when we do community economic development, not all the benefits are tangible and quantitative. Sometimes it's community capacity building to help them help themselves in economic development in the future. And that's something we could actually, within the department, we're talking about how would we get to better measure community development benefits or community economic development benefits, in that they're not quite quantitative, but they're important to be able to measure, especially if we're going to develop a performance measurement framework. So those are some of the questions that developing a performance measurement and monitoring framework for the department will put upon us to make sure that we do that.
Okay, thank you. How am I doing for time, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Houston, you have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. This is the what I have in my hand here is the application for financial assistance. So it's a one-page document, one-sided. We had asked for contact information, ownership information, current employment, annual payroll. So I'm just wondering what happens to this? Or how do you analyze something like that for funding? I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with this page or not.
I'm not sure from what program. Sorry. May I?
Certainly, Mr. Dontrema.
Sure. I'm not sure what program that is, but in my experience, the application form is only one part of the file of information. So often, for example, if I take the jobs fund, for example, we have an application form of a few pages, but the average file is this thick. Mm-hmm. So the reality is the application form forms a base to make sure we have the right tombstone data we need to know to establish mailing list, contact information, and these types of things. But most of the analysis that takes place by our officers on a file goes well beyond the application form, talking to the applicant, getting good sense of what the project is.
So this would be the thing you get about 3,000 of, I think was the number you used.
Yeah, we get 3,000 of those, but our files are much thicker than 3,000 pieces of paper.
So this would be best described as an inquiry as opposed to an application? Because from this you're going to decide whether or not you want to go further with them?
Our different programs have different milestones. Sometimes we go out, for example, we have a voucher program whereby we go out, I believe, quarterly with calls, where we put out a call and within the quarter people send us applications. We have the summer employment programs where we have a deadline in January or February and we get hundreds and hundreds of applications. Sometimes that's the process. Other times, companies or groups will just call one of our officers and start having a dialogue. What happens is sometimes it's prudent on behalf of our staff to actually talk the client through what they want to do and whether or not it's eligible. And if they're not going to be eligible, to tell them right off the bat so that they can avoid their time of filling out an application form and going through that process if it's not going to be fruitful. So the different programs have different mechanisms and in terms of whether or not you need to get the application at the front end. Often, the exploratory process of asking around is done by phone calls, visiting our websites and phone calls to our officers and staff.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. I would ask that you table that document just for the benefit of the other members in the committee. And now we will move to the NDP caucus with Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning.
It's very nice to have you here in front of us to talk about, I think, an area of government that is top of mind, not only for people here in this chamber, but for people in the province. And I think that certainly the Ivany Commission report has kind of focused our minds on whether or not the economic prosperity of the province is going to help Nova Scotia flourish, or whether, in fact, we will be experiencing a period of decline. So I want to ask some questions in light of that, because I think what Ivany reported, what the Commission reported, is not in many respects news, certainly not news to you folks. This is the reality that you've lived for some period of time. And I'd like you to help us understand your work in that context, and particularly in the time frame that this audit looked at the jobs fund, for example, and the companies that we see listed here with respect to the jobs fund. So I want to start by asking, I know some of you have worked in the department for quite a substantial time and others are more newcomers. Maybe first of all, you can just give the committee and the public the awareness of how long you've been in the department doing the work that you do, each of you, please.
Sure. Lonnie, would you?
So I've actually been in the department for 5 years. I started as the evaluation and performance measurement person. So part of the work that we did in the early part of the audit period in terms of introducing a performance measurement approach, that was work that I did with my team. I am now Executive Director of Policy and Planning. And so part of my responsibilities have been really looking at that strategic direction that Nova Scotia needs to take, and it's in partnership, not just with government, but all of the different sectors that we have in the province with businesses and communities. So part of the work that our branch does is cast an overview on how things are going, and in fact, we produced a lot of the background work for the Commission in terms of the economic statistics. So, thank you.
Chair. I've been with the department for 2 years, having spent 17 years with the federal government prior to that, including some time with ECOA and Industry Canada in the economic development business. And we've been working within the department. We have, as mentioned, quite a large team, a very dedicated, hardworking team, which I'm very, very proud and honored to be leading within the department. And over the last few years, we've been, the time that I've been there, we've been working hard to try to invigorate communities across Nova Scotia. We have a suite of programs that as we've mentioned. We focused a lot of our efforts on strengthening the workforce and the labor force, which is a key piece of advancing economic development. We've done a survey recently of Nova Scotia companies and asked them what their top impediments to business growth are, and workforce availability actually comes out as one of the top ones, if not the number one. We've also been working hard on productivity and innovation, which Wayne's group has been doing a lot of work on, and this is well aligned with the work that Ray Ivany is talking about, the role of universities in supporting research and development. There's lots of work that we can do there to spur innovation. We have a big productivity gap between us in Nova Scotia and the rest of Canada, and then between Canada and the U.S. So that productivity gap makes it very, very challenging for us to advance. And another key piece of work that we've been doing is around trade competitiveness, helping companies export, bring incremental dollars to the province. Of course, there are other many. We have a broad department. We have the tourism division as well, and the Nova Scotia Tourism Agency now that works to increase $2 billion worth of tourism revenues that we have. And the procurement shop for the province of Nova Scotia mm-hmm. sits within our department as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Larson.
I'm Jeff Larson. I've been with the province for just over 2 years in my position. Prior to that, I was a corporate finance lawyer and energy lawyer in Toronto. I worked at CIBC in Toronto as executive director and chief compliance officer of the CIBC Asset Management, which was the mutual fund, another fund business, before returning back home and being a vice president at a TSX-listed investment company and based out of Halifax, and taking a stint as an entrepreneur, starting some businesses, and practicing some law here as well at McGinnis Cooper. So.
Mr. Samara?
Hi. My name is Wayne Samara. I joined the province just a little over 2 years ago and head up the Productivity and Innovation Branch within our department. As Deputy Don Tromo mentioned, our team is focused around the department's innovation and learning programs designed to help businesses become more innovative, more productive, as well as help them in terms of workforce development. Prior to joining the province, I held a variety of senior leadership roles, both on the private and the public sector side of things.
Thank you very much. I think that's so helpful in helping us all understand, you know, that you're relatively recent recruits into our public sector, but you bring this very significant diverse experience that informs the work that you do. Now I want to look more specifically at the 10 companies that are identified in the auditor's report out of the jobs fund. And I want to ask you a bit about how much has been actually drawn down on these loans. We see that there has been approval for these 10, specifically for about in total $500 million. And I see that at the time of the audit, The total amount out of that fund, I think, was $611 million, but only at that point, $183 million had actually been drawn down. So can you give us a sense of where we're at now between the time that the audit was done and where we are today?
Sure. I'll ask Jeff to comment in more detail. As you point out, we make the arrangements for financial assistance. It often takes companies a number of years or some amount of time. Sometimes he's ordering heavy machinery. He's doing lots of work around their workplace. So it does take some time to be able to do those drawdowns. And while we've made some progress, we still have only put out a part of the funding as well. So I'll ask Jeff to comment on our current status. And if I can just add as well, we also, as part of our new processes and monitoring program, we're doing year-end reviews. We're having a more established process whereby we can, and back at the office is the type of information we have around, but we'll also be able to keep a tighter track on that as well and be able to inform ourselves with reporting and better budget management as well.
Sure. These are going to be estimates because I don't have the detailed figures. But Irving, I think, is approximately $35, $36 million that's been drawn down. Pacific West, which is the Port Hawkesbury paper, the full amount. Bowater Mersey, that transaction, the original transaction didn't proceed, so there had been an advance of $10 million that was returned. Subsequently, the province acquired the shares, and there was a loan that was provided to settle some of the intercompany balances. There's about $4 or $5 million outstanding on that at this point. There were originally, I think, 19 or so had been drawn down, but the company has repaid the company which we now own has repaid the balance. Cook, I don't have that number. I think it's $16 million, but pardon me,
around there.
Northern, I think it's approximately. It's less than half, I believe. The major project that they're working on is an air precipitator, and that hasn't been drawn down, but there has been drawn down for their chip plant and some working capital. Chorus, I believe all of that is drawn. Port Hawkesbury Paper Forestry Infrastructure Fund. This is a different kind of one. This was meant to provide some capital to the company while it was in bankruptcy. It essentially went to the receiver, and it kept the supply chain alive with the hope that potentially there would be a buyer found for the mill, and if the buyer was found, that supply chain wouldn't have fallen apart and be non-existent. So it created kind of the conditions that if a buyer was found, that the mill would be successful. So the full amount of that was drawn down, and that was for truckers and silviculturists and those types of things.
So just to be specific, this was to support smaller businesses that are part of the supply chain for that larger entity?
That's right. I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship because if the larger... Nobody would come in and want to buy the mill if the supply chain had fallen apart. So it benefited the purchaser, but also... And that's an example where, it's difficult to do the financial analysis because you were dealing with a company that was bankrupt and you're dealing with a variety of small businesses that are truckers and so on and so forth. So can do a better job on all the work we do. Sometimes it's a little bit tricky. Blackberry, that was the $2 million advance that was returned, so there's nothing outstanding there. Michelin, that project hasn't proceeded. We're hopeful that we're going to be able to continuously work with Michelin, one of our very important contributors to the economy here, to do future expansions, but this project hasn't been drawn down. And the last one is EPC, or what we call Polycello, based out of Amherst, and I believe that full amount is drawn down.
Okay. Now, I think one of the things that is the most, it certainly was the most confusing for me as I tried to get my head around this portfolio of tools, I guess I would say, that you have at your disposal is... The differences, what are the differences between loans and forgivable loans and guarantees and contributions. It would be useful, I think, to have a sense of that. And also, I wonder if you can give us an idea of the ratio for those things. I mean, are most of the financial incentives contributions? Are they repayable loans? Are they what is the ratio in the actual the support, financial support you give to various companies?
Sure, I'll start off and pass it on to Jeff. The Jobs Fund design is designed to have flexible tools in terms of having all these different mechanisms available. One of the reasons that is the Jobs Fund's design and the IAF, its predecessor in part as well, was designed to achieve not only economic goals, but also regional socioeconomic and social goals. Because the concept of saving a community, for example, from an economic mishap is more than just an economic issue. So because of that, not all of the challenges that appear in front of us that need fixing are as per the discussion earlier about the application form, they don't all fit neatly on an application form. You know, what are you applying for? Well, my community's in danger. Having a suite of programs whereby you can apply for just one tool would not likely give us the flexibility to in this particular case, for example, go and try to save a community from an economic mishap. So we need those flexibilities in our tools in order to be able to come up with these types of innovative solutions. And another thing to comment as well, in terms of Jeff's going to go through maybe and talk a little bit about the different types of tools, in terms of how their impact, just to clarify what I said a bit earlier around their impact on the operating budget, from a state easiest perspective, when we give a loan and we collect it all, there's no cost to the province other than our cost of funds. When we provide whether incentives like grants or they're forgivable or we take write-offs, those impact the operating budget of the province for the year in which they happen. So I'll pass it on to Jeff, who can talk a little bit more about the spectrum of different tools that are available and maybe an idea on the ratio.
Sure. As the deputy mentioned, there's a variety of different tools. Loans, I think we're all relatively familiar with, and they have the benefits of obviously getting repaid, but also the ability of taking security. If there's a concern about the ability to actually get repaid or if the fact that the security may be insufficient, then that is when we would take a reserve on that kind of loan as well, and that would have an impact on the operating budget. Sometimes you take a reserve, though, and you actually get repaid, which is a pleasant surprise, and we've had a few of those over the last 3 or 4 years that were positive developments because it was able to help a business transition through a tough period, and that comes back into the income statement as a recovery. We have forgivable loans, which are really it's a form of a grant where if they earn the conditions, they are entitled to not have to repay that loan. But it enables you to take some security as well, so that if they don't meet the conditions of the forgivable loan, you can actually demand repayment, and you have some security to do that. So it's a more robust form of a grant in a sense, in a way. There's the converse, which is a conditional grant, which is you grant somebody money on the condition that they do certain things, and if they don't, then you can demand payment, but you don't have security under a conditional grant. And there's accounting standards about how you treat each of those depending on the circumstances. The Jobs Fund also from time to time has made equity investments. It's made investments in Composites Atlantic in Lunenburg, where its partner is Airbus Global, which is the manufacturer of the Airbus planes based out of France. And there's an equity investment with DSME, the second largest shipbuilder in the world, based out of Trenton.
In addition, there's occasionally developmental incentives that we that the investment division will work on, which are a form of grant, usually for a quasi-infrastructure type of situation. So the Cape Breton Railway would be a situation where there really isn't a business case for that entity to continue to operate unless they receive a form of subsidy. The Digby Ferry is another circumstance where a development incentive has been provided. Am I missing anything here? Sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Don Tremont?
I can add, we've also used, the Jobs Fund can be used to fund other initiatives, and one of the most successful initiatives that we funded in the past was the Credit Union Small Business Loan Guarantee Program. So, for example, that's a program that we need to do a better job, actually, letting entrepreneurs know around the province that we have an arrangement with credit unions whereby we'll provide loan guarantee of up to 75%, and we're working on amendments to change that to 90% for some types of loans. Now, actually, it exists for 90% for some types of loans as well, to encourage the credit unions to extend credit to small business for them to grow their business. And through that program, it's been hugely successful, and it's a real success story for the work that we've been doing, is that we've put out over $55 million in the last 10 years, and our loss rate there as well is less than 5%. So when we're playing in a slice of business that has a risk profile greater than what the banks and private capital and equity markets are prepared to do, and we put out that amount of money to support small business, and we've spread a 5% loss over 10 years, it's really a very small cost. I think most Nova Scotians would agree that in terms of that part of doing economic development is a very small cost to spur on a lot of great community-based development.
We're, I think, in a period of transition. You've talked earlier about, a new government, different approach. They have gone out to find consultants to do a review of how you do economic development and the tools we've just talked about. But that work hasn't been done yet. So we're in a situation now where business in the province continues, and business can't necessarily put their business on hold to wait for the results of some study or some process. So my question to you is, how is the department operating right now with respect to the needs of the business community? What rules are you using? What programs are you using? How's that all working out at the moment?
Sure. Excuse me, Mr. Dontremont, you may have a chance to answer that later, but Ms. McDonald's time has expired. We'll now move to the Liberal Caucus and Mr. Rankin.
Yes, thank you for coming in today and answering the questions that the committee has. I wanted to clarify the direction that this province has been engaged in over the last number of decades. I appreciate the cursory explanation of what the new mechanisms that you have in place and what they can do to improve performance. I especially appreciate the words better budget management today, which I believe to be a valuable paradigm shift from the direction that this province has been going in over the last number of decades. My first question would be, do you recognize that implementing stricter controls going forward and initiating the new Accountability Act will improve outcomes?
Definitely, that having better controls is just good business. The vast majority, we fully accepted the recommendations of the Auditor General's office in their review because they're good recommendations. They make sense for us, and they make sense for most organizations, that having more rigor around your processes, improving the way that you're doing your business, is bound to be good for us as practices. And we also need to build the confidence of Nova Scotians in the work that we do to support economic development. And if Nova Scotians don't have the confidence that we can do a good job, it makes it difficult for you as government and our elected leaders who have to speak and face our electorate every day, they need the confidence that their government and the province and us as a civil service are working really hard and really well to support their interests. So improving accountability and transparency are good general practices for any business. It's good for us. It keeps us on our toes, make sure we're doing a good job, and builds the trust of Nova Scotians that we're going in the right direction. So I think going back earlier as well to comments made about the Ray Ivany piece, and we've hired Dr. Tom Travis to do some work for us as well. Any go-forward plans for us, if we decide to develop some new programs to meet those types of needs that are raised and so on, of course, applying the lessons learned from the Auditor General's report on those and making sure that those new programs are part of our new suite with its program management, new program management and monitoring functions, will make them all much better. So I think you know, we've come from a place where under the maybe Industrial Expansion Fund in years past, where we had very little for process and guidelines and good mechanisms and good controls. We've made a lot of progress since 2011, but we've got a ways to go. You know, we went from having almost no processes and practices to now that we've got them, but we're not implementing them perfectly yet. We're hitting 70, 80, and 90% in terms of our implementing them. So we've gone to good maybe, but we need to get to great. We need to get to 100%. So that's the new agenda. I've sent out a memo to all my staff and managers, and people know that there's a new spirit of compliance and good practice within the department, and that will drive not just guideline change and paper change, but a cultural change within the organization to be accountable, transparent, and to have good practice.
Okay, I appreciate that answer. There's very good words in there about a new spirit, and it's very similar to some of the words used in the Ray Ivany report. I think it's good that it's very timely that the report comes out at the beginning of a new government mandate. And although it's not news to many, it does use unequivocal language that we're not really in a period of transition. We're, in fact, some of the words were used that we're at the edge of a precipice. So we do have some opportunities to go forward, but certainly what's been happening over the last number of decades has been troublesome, to say the least. I'll digress back to what was mentioned earlier about the first paragraph, which is on page 26, where you highlight that the Jobs Fund guide was not being enforced, despite that the guide was being developed for the Jobs Fund. So application forms were not completed and document analysis was not conducted. I'm wondering why this guide was not being followed. Would the Executive Council have knowledge that applications were incomplete prior to the approval?
So we have a guide. Often we have some very talented staff within the department who have very, very good judgment. And there are times where the guide, as I mentioned earlier, the Jobs Fund is a flexible tool that has the flexibility built in, because not all challenges that are presented to us are created equal. They all need a little bit different approach. And because they need a different approach, you need to put more emphasis on one part of the deal and maybe less on another. And there's not a lot of consistency there. I think our officers, and I'll maybe pass it to Jeff, he has some other comment as well. We have officers who have great judgment, and they use that judgment to say that particular part of the checklist is less relevant in this particular case, so I don't need to do that, or I'll do it in my head. But the reality is, if you do that, we don't demonstrate the transparency and accountability that the Auditor General or ourselves should expect. So we need to get better to make sure that we don't do things in our head, that we need to standardize the processes and procedures, and we make sure that we do a good job. We have very good processes. We have that analysis that's done. We have lots of checks and balances on the Jobs Fund. So the officer does the analysis. The investment director looks at that analysis before, even though we didn't get sign off on it and get the signatures, even though there was the revision done. It goes to the independent Jobs Fund Advisory Board, who are experienced, very bright business people who play a strong challenge function with us. They make sure that we do lots of work and good due diligence. Then we prepare that information. It goes through sign-offs of senior legal and finance officers, myself, and then goes up to the minister as some options. And then it's the minister's recommendation to Executive Council that ultimately paves the way forward for that.
So
just to add to that, okay. The with compliance and controls, it's important to have the culture of compliance, a risk-based approach, and also technical compliance. And I think we are making great strides on all three. We were developing the process guide during this time period following the 2011 audit, and historical approaches to things like Michelin, the IEF had been dealing with them for 40 years, going and asking for an application form from Michelin was, from a risk-based approach, perhaps thought as not imperative. Now, I think the Auditor General has made a good point, though. Just make it imperative. Have good technical compliance. From a risk-based approach, maybe it wouldn't be as critical, but you might miss something. So, the tone is set from the top, and the deputy is setting the right tone for compliance. He is and creating the right culture. And that's the kind of thing that we will see evolve. So we really do appreciate the comments, but it needs to be a three-pronged approach, not just the technical compliance. We also need to understand the risk and have the right culture, and that's what we're doing. Some of the things, for example, the Irving contract, where it's a 30-year federal contract for $25 billion, the approach of analyzing that, given the contractual certainty from a risk-based approach, might be different than you would analyze a company that really is going to have to sell something the next week in order to make payroll. And so how you might do your risk-based approach to that analysis would between those two companies would be different. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the right technical things that would be outlined in the guide for all of the files and do the change our modus operandi a bit to ensure that we do the very best job we can. And that's an evolution. You know, it takes a bit of time for an organization to adopt not just the technical changes, but also the cultural and the risk-based approach.
Okay, that's a good response. I'm conscious of time, so I'll probably come back, but I want to give my colleagues a chance to ask some questions.
Mr. Stroink.
Thank you very much for coming in today. I want to refer to 3.8, talks about the monitoring of financial assistance programs and how current monitoring isn't sufficient. The report cites that the Capital Investment Incentive Program requires all equipment to be used here in Nova Scotia. Has the ERDT found any instances where the specific requirement was not followed?
I'm going to pass that off to Jeff, but because as more subject matter expert, whether or not we know or not.
Mr. Larson.
I'm not aware, but I don't have the information right now to provide a full response on that. So,
would you be able to provide that to us at a later date?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. I'll pass it on to Bill here.
Mr. Horn.
Yes, thank you. I'm pleased to see you here today, and I hope we can get some clarifications on some issues. The ones I'm looking at is under Section 3.22 of the report highlights that 3 out of 10 job fund files tested did not obtain financial statements from the client. Is this an oversight, or is it because of your workloads that this would have happened, or not enough staff, or what would?
Sure, I'll start off, and maybe Jeff. Sometimes we deal with publicly traded companies whose financial statements are available online. So if our analyst looks at those financial statements online and doesn't make a note and print them off, put them in the file and put a note on the financial statements that they did the review, it's not evident to anyone looking at the file that type of work was done as well. There may be other instances where having the financial statement, there may be other issues at play in terms of recently defunct companies or so on that make the value of the financial statement to the file maybe less important. But I think it's good practice for us, if we don't have a financial statement on the file, to put a detailed note on the file why we would not, as opposed to just leave it off. And that's why having that checklist to remind us to put that type of diligence in the file is very helpful. I don't know, Jeff, if you've got anything to add.
The deputy is correct. An example would have been Michelin. You know, they're a publicly traded global company out of France with an annual report that's, you know, 300 or 400 pages, where there's, I think, two mentions of Nova Scotia, despite the fact that Nova Scotia and South Carolina are their main North American hubs. So I think a circumstance like that, the previous approach might have been to think about, well, is the relevance of that such that we need to focus on that particular issue, or should we focus on a different issue? But going forward, that's not going to be the case. We're nonetheless going to do it and make sure we spend extra time to go through and see what's in that report and if there's particular challenges. A similar case would have been with RIM, for example, publicly traded company. The financial situation and challenges of RIM would be well known to investment staff, but unless you actually print it off and actually do your kind of summary of I've reviewed this and here's essentially what it's saying, you don't have it documented from a technical perspective in the file, and you don't know what you might find. So we're going to ensure that our investment managers continue to enhance their policies and procedures so that in the future those types of situations will nonetheless be addressed.
So documentation will be much more increased with...
That's right. I mean, currently the evolution of the files is dramatic, too. So if you look at a current file from the last year or two, the thickness is much, much more than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago, and we are committed to continuously improving and enhancing our policies and procedures. I don't want to make excuses because it's our responsibility. We're professionals, and we have the responsibility to do that. But we are working hard, and we have people who want to do a good job. They want to do the right things, and we have the right leadership with the deputy and the right culture that we're developing, and we're going to continue to improve and enhance. And it can't just be a risk-based approach. We need to be technically get to our 100% and move forward.
So could you say then that you haven't missed very many financial statements from the clients?
When we,
what percentage might be of missed?
Well, I think of the 10, for example, that the Auditor General reviewed, okay. There was the ones that he commented on. And when you talk to your investment managers, you know, the rationale for that would be along the lines of what I just said. So, but that the deputy has made it clear that's not going to be an excuse anymore. We're going to make sure that we do the full review and make sure it's documented. Often the review will happen with a publicly traded company, for example, where you'll do your analysis of RIM, but they'd say, well, this isn't a private company where I was emailed the either review engagement or audited statements, and I'm going to put it in the file. But going forward, those processes will be enhanced.
Okay, so would you be saying that you've not missed any of the financial statements from the companies, the clients that are looking for funding? You know, it's hard for the province to make good loans and so on if you don't have a financial statement from
I'm not aware of any other than the ones that the Auditor General highlighted.
And you're saying those could have been just because you look on the computer to see their statements?
Yeah, I believe that the ones that he referred to were Michelin, Research in Motion,
which are public,
and maybe Chorus. I may be incorrect because I don't have it on my at the tip of my hands here.
Right.
But that was my recollection. But I don't want to. When I say that the investment manager would have nonetheless reviewed, for example, Mission Online, that they wouldn't have done the same level of analysis on Michelin's financial statements historically as they would have on a smaller privately held company, because I think there was a risk-based thought that, well, this is a different kind of thing. But going forward, I think our clear direction and the right direction is, nonetheless, you use the same level of due diligence, and you just make sure that that there's nothing missing there.
Okay. Satisfied. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you. I want to change gears a little bit to get away from the AG's report, and I just want to ask you a little bit about the
how the programs get out into the community. Do you feel that the programs that are available to businesses in the province are well enough known and that businesses are well enough aware of the programs that are out there? And can you maybe in the course of answering that just tell us some of the ways that some of the steps you're taking to make businesses aware of the programs that are offered through ERDT?
Sure, thanks. That's a really good question. We have a network of field officers who are out there in offices and in many communities, in your communities, around the province, who people know that they can call and contact if they're looking for assistance. We have a web-based presence, but we've been working in the last year to try to clean up our web-based presence. When you've got 28 programs in a long list on the web, on the web, it's not the the best way for people to access your services. So we've been working on cleaning those up into like five or six key pillars, so people looking for trade advice can look in the trade pillar as opposed to having five trade programs to try to sift through. We really try to use our field staff as navigators to make sure that people have an easy way. Because doing research on the web in terms of program assistance, if you don't find it in three clicks, you're going to give up and move to somewhere else. So we are really encouraging people to call into our field staff and say, I've got an idea. How would I support my idea? They know of the 28 programs, the two or three or one that they're eligible for, and can take them right there. So that's a process we like to use. We're trying to improve our web presence as well, not just by cleaning that up, but developing web portals in collaboration with Service Nova Scotia and Municipal Relations. We're working on a system whereby when companies want to apply, for example, to make things easier, of course, making the application process less, more painless is helpful as well. So we're working on a process whereby companies can type in their company, their business number, and we can download the tombstone information from the Registry of Joint Stocks, auto-fill the application form, name, address, phone number, contact, articles of incorporation, or whatever they need to really help that process so they can get down to actually talking about the details of their business. So we're working on that as well. We're also working to clarify the roles and responsibilities and mandates between the many different players. There's us and NSBI and Film and Creative Industries and Innova Corp. There's a number of different players. We're trying to build a Team Nova Scotia approach. And Ray Ivany actually talked about this. Some of the best examples of how when companies came to us and said, we felt really well served in Nova Scotia, is when one of the economic development team, like someone on Jeff's team, for example, got a lead from a company who wanted to locate Nova Scotia. And had a little chat with them and said, what do you need? They say, well, we're going to need some help with the Department of Environment, Department of Energy. We want something, help here, some help there. We need some fiber, natural resources. And one of Jeff's staff may call everyone to one meeting. The client comes and meets everyone all at once and gives them one pitch. It's a great, they come away feeling so well served, because we had companies come to us and they said, we just came from Quebec and we had to have eight meetings to accomplish what we accomplished at this one meeting here. So once we do that, what happens is the staff at the meeting figure out, what do I need to take back to my department to and allow this to happen? And everyone kind of carves up the work, and we get together in the background as a coordinated group and get back to the company with a one province of Nova Scotia response. We're prepared to do X and cover all the files, because there's nothing that drives companies gives them a hard time than when they have to deal with multiple parts of the province that don't feel like they're dealing with one province of Nova Scotia. Because there's other levels of government to deal with as well. So at a minimum, we need to get our act together. So that's something we're continuously trying
to
improve.
Excuse me, Mr. D'Entremont. Yeah. Thank you for your response. The time has expired. We'll move to Mr. Houston for 14 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify.
Mr. Larson?
I guess I said that I wasn't aware.
Excuse me. Mr. Larson? Just waiting for your mic to come on. Mr. Larson. Mr. Larson.
Hello.
There. Hi. I just wanted to clarify one comment. I said I wasn't aware of any other examples, but an example of where we might not have financial statements would be at the Yarmouth Ferry. So it's a new company. It had never existed before Novastar. So they wouldn't have historical financial statements. There's another example, Cellufuel, which was a new company. So from time to time, that would be the case, or for the Forestry Infrastructure Fund, where I mentioned that it was actually going to a receiver for a bankrupt company, Port Hawkesbury Paper. previously new page. So there may be circumstances, but where there are those circumstances, what we're going to do is clearly document in the file what those circumstances are. So when the Auditor General looks at it, he understands, okay, at least there was a reason. Because historically, somebody might have said, okay, well, there isn't any, so I'm not going to put anything in the file. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I just thought about that, and I didn't want to have any misunderstanding if later on.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Statement was made that better controls are good business, and I can tell you that as a chartered accountant, I certainly agree with that statement. And I'm also glad to hear that this team is trying to implement a cultural shift and some cultural changes, and you certainly strike me as a well-qualified team, so those are comforting things to me. But better controls are good business if they're followed. If the controls are not followed, then they simply can't be trusted. So my concern is, as long as there is political interference and political slush funds, your guys' job has the potential to be incredibly frustrating. So I want to ask you today a little bit about what's the impact that the Cabinet has on the Government Jobs Fund. And specifically, can Cabinet effectively ignore your advice and disperse funds based on their own agenda?
Mr. D'Entremont.
So we have processes for Jobs Fund applications that we follow and that are followed rigorously, in that the officers who are working on the file always do analysis to provide the best advice that we can. We bring those to the Jobs Fund Advisory Board, who gives it a second pair of eyes and gives us good advice on how what the risks are of the deal, what the benefits are of the deal, and how to improve the deal. We then go through the process of signatures. And as you mentioned, you've got good controls if they're followed. So now we've got a much more rigorous process of making sure that through the senior management chain, we sign off on all the different pieces of information that are going forward to make sure that if there's a piece missing, we'll send it back to make sure it gets done. Then after that, the advice of the Jobs Fund Advisory Board goes to the minister. It's the minister's recommendation to take it to an Economic Investment Committee and to Executive Council. So ultimately, Executive Council needs to make the decisions on whether or not to support a different proposal or not. But it has always gone through the whole process of all the way up to Executive Council. After Executive Council makes a decision, that is government policy. Our job is to implement that policy, so the file comes back down to us for management.
Right. So as we sit here today, you could build up the biggest file in the world, should you choose, and have a recommendation that effectively, if there was a strong voice in the Cabinet, they could, and there was no business case in your mind, that strong voice could effectively push that project through. That's the way it is from what I hear. It kind of goes through your processes, you do all your checks and balances, you make a recommendation, which could be accepted and followed, or ignored and not followed. Is that, just on that very specific point,
Technically,
is that the case today?
Technically, it's the minister's recommendation on an R&R that goes to Executive Council. So we support and provide advice to the minister, but it's the minister's recommendation.
Right.
So whether or not Executive Council wants to follow or not follow the minister's recommendation is up to Executive Council. Once they make a decision, we implement that decision.
Great. Thank you. Now, I had the opportunity to hear the Premier speak yesterday at a function, and he made mention of investing in social projects. I wonder if the minister, or maybe somebody from the Premier's office, has talked to you guys about social investing and social projects at this stage.
We've had ongoing discussions within the department for the last couple of years on social enterprise. We have a pilot project with the credit union through our credit union loan guarantee program, where we provide guarantees for social enterprise, which are business-like entities who create revenues like a business would, but that the profits are not don't go to individuals, but they're reinvested in some philanthropic exercise. So right. That's been an ongoing discussions within the department. I can't recall a specific discussion, although it's a topic that when I raise with folks, there's general enthusiasm that it's going in the right direction, and there's general support.
Yeah, fair enough. So I'm just wondering if what we were hearing yesterday maybe was just kind of a change in terminology as opposed to a change in direction, because we did hear like the now government, when they were in opposition, they were very critical of some of the investments and some of the cash disbursements that the government made. And they were very vocal against bailouts. And now I think what I'm just trying to get my head around is, has there been any kind of a change there? It seems like, to your mind, there hasn't, and maybe there might be the same types of investments will continue to be made, but just under a different term. And I just want to get the clarification that you really haven't had. There's kind of been no change in your mandate. It's just, you know, how it might be described publicly will be different. And is that sort of the case, that nobody has sat down with you and said, guys, we're going to take a look at what we invest in here, we're going to make some changes?
We've been having discussions about the way forward with the Ray Ivany piece coming in, and Tom Travis doing a review of our programs and tools, and as well I've hired a gentleman by the name of Gilles Deroufflet and Ellen Farrell at St. Mary's University to do a review of venture capital. We're getting a number of inputs that are coming into us now that can form the basis of some new directions. If the government is interested in pursuing some of those directions as per Ray Ivany's direction or what Tom Travis recommends, we're there to help them support and deliver their agenda. We, as the civil service, that's what we do. Mm-hmm. We support the government of the day.
So I think I heard you say if that's what the government wants to do, if they want to follow, you know, the recommendations of the Ivany report, you're certainly going to help them, and I respect that. I've heard government saying, holding the Ivan report up and saying, this is our blueprint for managing this province, and this is exactly what we're going to do, and we are never going to make a decision unless it's consistent. I'm paraphrasing. But obviously the Ivan report is pretty important in the eyes of the now government. I'm wondering if the minister maybe has sat down with you, Mr. D'Entremont, and said, This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to take this. Or have those discussions not taken place yet?
We haven't had those discussions in great detail. Ray Ivany's report is getting generally starting a good dialogue with many people. But the impact of the Ray Ivany report can be broader than just economic development. He touches on lots of files that are related to the economy, but that are not the lead within our department, for example, talking about immigration, talking about different types of policies that impact different departments. So those are discussions that will be a little bit broader than with us. But we've had... You know, we're bound to have discussions about a way forward, given that we have all these inputs and we plan to collect them all and for us to be able to provide advice to our minister.
Thank you for that. One of the recommendations from the Ivan report, or one of the goals, rather, was that we double the amount of business startups in this province. I'm just wondering what a term like that means to you folks. Do you play a role in that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Entrepreneurship and the startup economy is a good basis for any business development program. The Ray Ivany work found, interestingly, that there's nothing. The strategies that we were working on in terms of trying to support economic development, if you asked the Forefront Conference, if you asked the Atlantic Provinces Economic Council, if you ask economists, if you ask a lot of people, what do you need as an economic strategy, to what policy things do you need to support economic development, they all say ballpark the same thing. You need a workforce development, innovation, productivity, trade competitiveness, access to capital. The list sounds very much the same. So we keep saying, if we're doing all those things, why aren't we seeing the results? And I think where Ray is a bit going is that It's like we've opened the door for people to walk through, but there's not enough people walking through the door. We've opened the right door, and it's open, but there's just not enough volume. So Ray is saying we need to take small, high-growth startups and business, small businesses that can grow very quickly and that have potential to export and bring incremental revenue into the economy are going to be very important in building a base. So we just need more. We need so we need to make sure we have the tools to help businesses start up. So the credit union loan guarantee program that we have is very helpful. Bringing technical skills through some of our co-op programs will be very helpful. And we invest in entrepreneurship through First Center for Entrepreneurship Education and Development and so on. So we have some investments that we've been making in entrepreneurship in the startup community. Also through InnovaCorp, one of our partners at part of the portfolio reporting to our minister, invest in venture capital for small high growth firms. So we have lots of tools looking at small business. They're maybe less well known and we need to make sure we address that. But I think over the next little while, we'll undoubtedly be looking at do we have the right suite of tools for the startup economy and for business startups, and to make sure whether or not we can enhance what we have or come up with new ones will undoubtedly be part of the dialogue.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that and I agree with that. The thing that concerns me is how do we get there? So, you know, and I'm just trying to balance that against the situation that you guys find yourselves in, which I'm very sympathetic to, that you could do a lot of analysis and make decisions on things that then get vetoed at a higher process, you know, particularly on the jobs fund, right? So we need to you know, it's the job of government to create an environment where business has an opportunity to be successful. And when you guys are out there talking to companies, prospective companies that might come to Nova Scotia or might grow in Nova Scotia, I'm sure you're hearing certain themes of why they're setting up their next warehouse somewhere else, or why they're not hiring here and they're hiring in New Brunswick. And I'm just wondering if you can just shed a little bit of light on those types of themes. I assume that having some of the highest taxes in Canada, It probably doesn't make a lot of entrepreneurs optimistic about their prospects here, and probably power rates and stuff. But I don't want to make that assumption. I'd like to hear what you're hearing entrepreneurs are saying to you.
Sure. Another great question as we try to work our way forward to figure out what is the best way to grow the economy. Part of the work that we do in supporting businesses one at a time through our programming is only part, as you mentioned, of the sphere of whether or not companies want to come to Nova Scotia or grow in Nova Scotia. Through our programming, we may touch, and I'm just throwing a number, please don't quote me on it. Let's say we touch one out of every 500 businesses with our programming, that we give some kind of assistance to hire a co-op student or develop new trade markets. We also need to think of what are we doing for the other 499 to make sure that they can grow. So we have a role as government to create the winning conditions for them to be able to succeed. And those types of things include a number of factors. They include taking down trade barriers between countries and between provinces, liberalization and harmonization of different things like apprenticeship, which we're working on right now. Our partners at LEE have agreed with the other three Atlantic provinces on four types of apprentice, where we're going to harmonize our requirements for that. Because right now, you could start 1 year as in one trade and then go to another province to take your second year, and they've inverted the program. So we're looking at all those different pieces.
I'm going to run out of time, sure. So I want to stop you, and I do want to thank you guys. And I also want to offer to you that if you ever want to discuss any files with me or need any advice on anything, I'd be more than happy to chat with you.
Thanks for the offer.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. And we'll move to the NDP caucus with Ms. McDonald.
Pro bono. He didn't mention that, but pro bono. I was asking a question about what are we doing right now in terms of, let's say there's a business in Nova Scotia today that has an opportunity or has a problem, and they come to your department. What set of rules are we playing by? What are the approaches that we're using right now? to deal with problems while we're waiting for the review that's underway that will bring us to this new and glorious change.
Mr. Dontremont.
Thank you, Chair. The programs that we have are only part of quite a broad suite of programs and tools. As we know, we have Film and Creative Industries, we have NSBI, we have InnovaCorp. So we have a lot of different players involved in economic development, such to the point that Ray Ivany and others have commented that there's a lot of people doing economic development around. We've got a COA, we've got different levels of government. There's lots of business development agencies, and we have established relationships with all those agencies. There's lots of opportunity, and because we're part of the same club, we're talking to the same clients and so on, there's lots of opportunity to employ that Team Nova Scotia approach. And even though if that Team Nova Scotia was eight players before and is seven players now, for example, if we can't participate for one reason or another, there's still lots of tools out there. We have our Small Business Credit Union Loan Program, which is very active. We have venture capital investments through NSBI and InnovaCorp. So there's a number of different tools and a number of different ways to us to continue to advance the economic development
so
agenda.
So are you saying that there's the Jobs Fund is on hold, that we would send a business to ACOA or find out some other part of our own portfolio to deal with their issue?
No, we're actually
trying to understand.
No, we're continuing to work on a pipeline of business development, mm-hmm. and we're having conversations. At the end of the day, we'll present options to government, and they'll decide whether or not they want to proceed. So that's their decision, their prerogative. But we continue to have a pipeline of companies that we work with to try to undertake initiatives in their various stages, and we'll be presenting those to government when.
So, and we're using the same essential components, loans, loan guarantees, contributions.
At the end of the day, that'll be a decision of government, what tools and what types of tools they're prepared to use.
But that's what we're doing right now.
That's
what's in place right now.
We're having conversations. Yeah, those tools, as they existed before, still exist. And
nothing has changed.
The option is there for government to continue to use them if they would like.
We're still doing the same things then, right now, that we were doing 3 months ago, 5 months ago. We have the same
programs and same tools exist in their current form right now.
Thank you. So one of the things that I notice in the AG's report is around the economic analysis that was done on these 10 companies in the jobs fund. And if I'm reading this correctly, I think the AG found that in 9 of the 10 files, an economic analysis was in fact done. But one of the 10 files, there wasn't. It wasn't completed. And I'm not really sure which one that is. I don't know if you can shed any light on that, if you can tell us which one didn't have an economic analysis assessment, and why that was.
Sure. That would be the Forestry Infrastructure Fund, the $12 million investment. For that particular investment, usually the way we do our economic analysis is that we want to know what our return on investment is for the province, and we base it on taxation income to the province from employment, and that's a general part of our analysis. That type of analysis makes sense when the benefits are job creation. So if you want to create 100 jobs, you want to figure out what the payroll tax is going to be on the payroll of 100 jobs, and that's how you help establish at least what the economic argument. There can be social and socio-regional and so on arguments as well. For the Forestry Infrastructure Fund, the goal of the project was not to job creation for the company. It was to keep the supply chain for forestry going. So the goal there was that whoever took over the Port Hawkesbury mill would require an active supply chain. Once the supply chain dries up, there's a risk you'll never get it started again. If the foresters move out west, if people, the truckers sell their trucks, and that supply chain dries up, then when you want to take over the mill, the supply chain is dry and you can't get it going again. So given that the focus was on keeping the supply chain, our analysis was around the benefits of the supply chain and being able to keep it going rather than on the economic analysis of the job creation, of which there was some, but it wasn't the primary motivator in that particular case.
So of the 10 files that were checked, an economic analysis was done on 9 out of 10, and the one for which there was no economic analysis done, it would have been quite difficult to do that, and it would have formed part of the larger Pacific West analysis at any rate, I would think.
Yes, and it wasn't the primary motivation for us. So we were measuring other benefits primarily because those were the other benefits we were trying to get.
I noticed that you have accepted all of the recommendations and you have implemented many of the recommendations and other recommendations are in process. But I also noticed recommendation 3.10, which is the one that makes the distinction, I think, between capital and working capital, and your response on that, that reading between the lines of this gave me the impression that this recommendation at times will not be practical. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that, because it seems to me that sometimes the requirements and the pressures that are faced in the business world don't conform nicely to the processes of government, which take so much more time in my experience and can get bogged down in a lot of red tape sometimes. There's a tension there. And this recommendation seemed to reflect that a bit for me.
Sure. Happy to comment. When we looked at this recommendation, which is a sound recommendation, that good practice in terms of accountability and transparency is that companies or clients should incur costs and we would reimburse those costs. And that's a good practice and that's a nice, safe way of doing our business. But as you mentioned, the Jobs Fund is a flexible tool. We talked earlier about guarantees and forgivable loans, lots of tools. One of the tools that are available is provision of working capital. The challenge with the concept for us, and it's not a challenge per se in that it's an option for us that we can pursue if government wants to make it so, is that for companies who need working capital from us, by definition, don't have enough working capital and don't have a good availability of funds. So for them to have to incur the expenses first and then submit us the receipts afterwards for us to be able to disburse would be challenging given they're asking for working capital and don't have enough. We'd be making their working capital needs a bit worse. If the other issue is, this is a generic recommendation that can apply to many of our programs. We deal with non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, and we have a program right now, for example, where we give them an advance of 50%. They incur some costs, send us some bill, we give them a bit more money, and that way we keep going. So for these small community-based organizations, getting the working capital requirement to be able to have the money, to spend the money for us to be able to give it to them is a bit of a challenge. We can implement that recommendation. When the deadline was due for this, we were in between governments. We had no way of asking our government whether or not they were prepared to undertake this, because this is more of a policy decision of government than it is a program implementation one. That being said, for some of our programs where we do have an expectation that they incur first and then we repay, we're going to tighten that up quite a bit to make, as per the recommendation, this is a good recommendation. But on the issue of making it mandatory for all our programs, it would by definition exclude working capital, and that's a policy decision of government. So if there's a time that government wants to make that decision, we're prepared to proceed. Jeff, you want to have
Mr. Larson? An example, just to crystallize in your mind, is the Yarmouth Ferry. Right? So they wouldn't have a pot of money that they are able to get started with. So we provide what's called an accountable advance. So the first advance might be $2 million, which allows them to have the cash to start executing on their strategy. They would then provide evidence that they spent the money and receipts and so on and so forth, and then another disbursement or an accountable advance could occur. So sometimes the businesses that we deal with and the solutions that that are trying to be addressed don't match up exactly, but the spirit of the recommendation is an excellent recommendation, which is make sure that you do get those receipts. Make sure that you do a good job of looking at them. How we do that, too, can be an issue because, you know, do you, and as an accountant, I'm sure people understand this, you know, do you want to look at 100% of the receipts or do you look at the receipts that really lead to 80% of the total dollar amount, and what's your risk-based approach to checking those things? So we are in complete agreement with the spirit of it, but with some of these things, you know, how would you handle a situation like the Yarmouth Ferry and their need for advances is not really a situation where us as the civil servants were able to say that that is something that government may or may not want to do.
Ms. McDonald.
I know my time is getting short. I have two very quick questions, and I want to thank you in case we run out of time for coming today. My last two questions are to the deputy. You have a lot of experience in this field. How would you characterize the kind of economic development investment climate that we're in right now and have been, let's say, at the time that this audit was done and looking back on, for example, those 10 files? And are there any jurisdictions that you're aware of in the rest of the country or in North America that have no public investment in private industry and provide no support through a variety of tools such as we talked about here today? Are there any jurisdictions?
I don't know. I'm not sure I have enough comprehensive knowledge of every jurisdiction to know that there's one without, but it's common practice for governments to have a bit of a role in economic development, but they exercise that in different ways. Some jurisdictions will focus on taxation, other incentives. There's different mechanisms, different ways of doing economic development. The work that we're doing, and we're going to get the answer to that question actually very soon, is the work we hired with Tom, Dr. Tom Travis, that we hired. He's been supported by an economist firm that we've hired, Millier Dickinson Blaise, and part of their work is doing a jurisdictional review, exactly asking that question. What are other jurisdictions doing? What are the best practices in economic development, and what are the different options for going forward? So it's a good question because we've asked the same one, and we're collecting that information right now from a firm who's got good experience looking across different jurisdictions, trying to find out what are the best practices, are there new and emerging practices, and in a way it depends the types of businesses you're trying to attract. For example, if you got a company like Michelin that you're trying to attract investment, or these large multinationals with branch plants in our province, there's an interesting dynamic that takes place there. Is their competitors are not other businesses in the same business. It's their sister plants in other jurisdictions, because the game that's played now is that they need to go to their head office, to their board, and make a pitch about why capital investment should flow in their direction.
Thank you, Mr. Dacoma. Time has expired. Mr. McGuire.
I want to thank you all for coming here today. I want to keep my questions quick and direct so that we are able to maximize the 14 minutes. So in response to the honorable member's comment around what this government is doing differently, we're taking a thoughtful approach to economic development, and the Travis Report will provide recommendations so that we don't make the mistakes of the past. I just want to do a bit of a follow-up on Mr. Horn's question here. I got a few notes here, so sorry. You'd said in the past that you did not obtain financial statements for all applicants, but going forward you will, which I guess is a clear difference between this government and past governments. Why now? Like, what is the difference, and was this not a pressing need over the last decade or two decades or whatever to obtain these financial statements?
We're on a path of continuous improvement. We've been making the 2011 audit found that we had some issues that needed some attention, so we continue to move the bar forward. As I said, we went from a place of having not a lot in controls and process guidelines to make sure we had consistent processes. We've come to a point now where we've developed them for the most part, and we're implementing them in the 70, 80, 90% range. It's to hit the 100% target that we're going to keep to push for. So I think we've gone to good, we need to get to great, and we need to keep pushing the envelope there.
So when it comes to these files that have come across your desk and you've made, recommendations to Cabinet, can you identify which individuals in the Premier's, in the past Premier's office would have been involved on these files? And would you say that these individuals were actively involved on these files?
I dealt with different people in the, was it the Premier's office you were interested in particularly?
Or the Cabinet level, sorry.
Oh, the Cabinet level.
Yeah, and the Premier's office both. So.
We deal with different members and different ministers' offices. Some of our files may touch on forestry. We'd have an interest in, through our minister perhaps, getting in touch with the Minister of DNR. We work with political staff as well in that political staff have at times good sense of the files and where things are going and what government's appetite is to undertake different initiatives. So our government needs the advice, political advice from political staff and policy advice from the department, so we keep in close touch.
So it'd be fair to say that they had intimate knowledge of these files.
Yeah, it's not uncommon, or in the experience that I've had with the province to date, that that political staff have an interest in the development of files within departments and keep in touch with them, want to have a knowledge of where things are at. They're a good mechanism to actually advise us on where our jurisdiction touches into other departments, because sometimes they're assigned. So we work with the political staff of the day. They are at liberty to organize themselves as they see fit, and we work with them as...
So did you ever... did they ever provide... direction, or did you ever receive direction from the Premier's office on these files?
I have lots of discussions with the Premier's office staff. They have often good knowledge. They are a good source of information for us in terms of what government is willing to do. Mm-hmm. So we may be referred files. They may have some insight into negotiation strategy that's helpful to work with clients. And we can use that to input into our process. But at the end of the day, we always go through our process of having the staff do assessment, a jobs and advisory board, go to... Jobs Under Advisory Board, followed by to the Minister to Cabinet.
So it is fair to say that there was some direction given from the Premier's office in the past?
There is connections with them, certainly, and they are a gauge for us as to whether or not governments are interested in undertaking initiatives and what types. There are times where in our negotiations we reach impasses and we need to seek the help of the political side of government, so we would seek the advice of our minister or other staff if they're the ones with more subject matter expertise on a particular file.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Rankin.
Thank you. I just wanted to make some further comments from a quote from the Premier yesterday. I think it's important to put into context when you're quoting it. So he said social responsibility to the people, in particular the most marginalized. So this isn't limited to economic and rural development. Certainly we have serious issues with the lack of housing in this province, wait lists for children needing early intervention, and all the rest. So I think the Premier has a very profound responsibility for social issues. Further to that, it was also mentioned, and I appreciate this, that it is common practice for government to have a role in economic development in other jurisdictions. So it's just really a question, and that's a matter of opinion, how much that role really has an impact. So it really shouldn't be astounding in my eyes that the minister responsible for that department has the final sign-off. After all, he's the elected member. The bureaucrats aren't elected. He's the one closest to the people and accountable to the electorate. I would expect that kind of practice to continue. It certainly is practice in all departments in government. One comparison I'll make is the HRM staff right now pushing through changes. They have a very strong business case to take down operating expenses at the landfill. $10 million sounds great in the fiscal books, but the electorate has to take responsibility for the impact that has on the local environment and the community. That's why we elect members to represent us, and all three parties agreed with my stance on that. So in that case, staff came up with a recommendation. Politically, it was shot down, and that's because we're accountable to the people, so it's important to make that distinction. It was also mentioned that we were critical then, and I think we're going to be critical going forward. We were certainly critical today. There's a lot of other things in this report that I find very scathing. There's over $100 million in Section 3.45 that was allocated to various businesses with basically no salary targets at the end of the day when the agreement was signed. Prior to that, when they did the economic analysis, all of these major deals had certain salary figures that were supposed to be set out. So that's the most troubling section to me in this whole report, that the economic analysis that the business case was given changed with those signed agreements. So I would assume the Department of Cabinet would want to see the maximum benefit for the dollars being allocated. So my final question, with time drawing down, is are you able to give any insight as to why the inconsistencies between the projections and the signed agreements existed? Was there clandestine-type meetings with the Premier or Economic Development Ministers and was it a case, is it possible to say that the private sector was able to out-negotiate the government with any of those deals? Would that be fair to say?
Sure, that's a very good question. The way our practice works is our officers sit down with companies and try to hammer out an agreement. And there's lots of different things at play. How much security we're going to get, how many jobs we're going to create, what are the benefits, and that is these are not kind of linear discussions. They're very flexible, and you have to be trading off different pieces for different pieces. So what happens is we may end up in a situation whereby we have a company who thinks that their projections and our analysis thinks that the most likely scenario, let's say, is they'll create 100 jobs. But then we try to negotiate an agreement. And let's say the government was interested in negotiating an agreement whereby there was loan forgiveness. The company may be hesitant to get into an arrangement whereby they negotiate that if they only create 99 jobs instead of 100, they get no forgiveness. So we may negotiate as part of our negotiations or come up with some options for government that say that if they get 90 jobs instead of the 100, they can get some loan forgiveness. And we have some examples in our files where that's the case. In many cases, that was made clear to the decision makers that there was a difference, or at least the two numbers appeared in the documentation, so it's not like only one number appeared, they didn't know the other. We can do a better job letting the decision makers know that if there's a 90 in it and 100, that we make that clear, that forgiveness is earned on 90, the original projection was 100, there's a difference of 10, you should know that before you make that. Sometimes it was in the documentation, and it wasn't always, you know, if you're reading different pages and it's at two different places, you might not pick up the fact that they're different. They were negotiated intentionally differently, but we need to do a better job to make sure that the people that look at those are well aware that that's the case. So we're going to do a better job there in the future. Jeff, you got something else?
Mr. Larson?
And for example, one of these is related to Michelin. And the intention of that isn't the creation of an additional 50 jobs per se, although that's a great benefit. With a company like Michelin and the footprint that they have, incenting continuous investment and leveraging significant investment by them increases their stickiness here, improves their productivity, makes it so that they're in their top quartile or top half of their plants. So if a company like that is doing a $100 million expansion, for example, and there's a $10 million incentive related to that, it may be low actual job creation, but that's not the primary policy objective per se. What we can do, I think, is do a better job of setting out clearly in our file the policy objective there and why, for example, in a case like that, a grant or forgiveness may not be linked to specific job targets and getting that kind of clarity around there. So I'm not trying to defend. We can do a better job on all of our files, and the situations the deputy mentioned, but also in explaining why something might be different.
Mr. D'Entremont.
Thanks. If I can add as well, we have other tools in our portfolio that might be more better suited to a situation where we're interested in the more is better scenario, where the more jobs will pay more. So rather than having the loan forgiveness piece, like I mentioned, the 100 and the 90 jobs, maybe perhaps they are less motivated once they hit 91 to push the envelope on job creation. What we can do is use the payroll rebates at NSBI, whereby the more you create, the more you get. And for that type of tool, it creates a much more linear plan for growth in that more is better. So they don't stop at 100. They can go to 110 as long as we let the cap go, 120, and keep pushing the envelope. So we work with our partners to find out what's the right tool for the right project. If it's employment-based, really a real hard-hitting job number piece, maybe payroll rebate's the better tool. If it's like Michelin, where it's big investment, the job numbers aren't maybe as big compared to the dollars, but we're just trying to get, as Jeff said, the stickiness. We're trying to anchor their investment in the province. Maybe one of our programs is a better tool.
Thank you, Mr. D'Entremont. The time for questioning has expired. You now have a chance to provide some closing remarks.
If I can find them. Thank you so much. Sorry for the shuffling of paper. Thank you so much. Thanks for the chance to talk about the department's programs and how we plan to make them better for the clients we serve in the business community, but also for Nova Scotians. We really feel the Auditor General's recommendations are going to be very helpful for us as an organization. They're good recommendations. We're developing a culture of compliance within the department that's going to allow us to be much, much better, much more accountable, much more transparent. We're hoping to be able to do a much better job in the future. I think we're doing a good job. We need to be great. We need to take in pushing those 70, 80, 90% compliance rates to 100%, making sure we document the file. I think our evidence, our track record of having loss rates on loans of less than 5%, as well as the less than 5% loss on the credit union loan guarantee program, are an effective wrap-up measure that we're doing a pretty good job. Of course, we always want to push that envelope and do better. And with the Ray Ivany piece and Tom Travis piece coming, I think if we work on new programming, new ways forward, we've got all these learnings which we'll immediately implement. We'll hit the ground running with those programs, doing them right off the bat.
Thank you very much,
thank you,
Mr. D'Entremont, and to the rest of your colleagues from the department for being with us today. Yes? Mr. D'Entremont.
Sorry, I also want to thank the team here and the great team that I have in the department who, over the last few years, and always do, they put in lots of time. They work evenings, they work weekends, they don't ask for a thing. They just want to pat on the back every once in a while. They're doing a good job, but they deserve it. I've got a fantastic team of professionals who've been working really, really hard. We're going to make this work. We're going to keep pushing the envelope, and I've got a great team to help me do that.
Thank you. We do have one piece of business remaining on the agenda before we take a short recess for our briefing for next week. It is a letter from the Auditor General dated January 17th. I believe you all have a copy. In that letter, the Auditor General has made three proposals. There's a further suggestion on research, which has been suggested could be deferred for the time being. So I think we should defer that for the time being. But the three proposals are: the first is that this committee formally accept and endorse recommendations contained in the Auditor General reports when they are issued, and ask the departments and agencies commit to and take responsibility for full and timely implementation of recommendations in which those departments have accepted. The second proposal is that this committee requests that the Deputy Minister's Audit Committee assume responsibility for ongoing monitoring and oversight of the implementation of recommendations from the Auditor General and take a proactive role in promoting full and timely implementation. And the third proposal is that this committee accept and approve the Auditor General's May 17th letter, which contained an additional proposal that this committee consider holding a hearing at least yearly on the status of implementation of audit recommendations, possibly subsequent to the annual follow-up report by the Auditor General. And that hearing would require the attendance
of the chair of the audit committee and possibly other selected deputy ministers whose performance in this respect might be lagging. So there are three proposals. I would like to open it up to the floor for discussion. Would anybody like to comment, or Mr. Rankin?
Yeah, in regards to recommendation number one, we do endorse the idea of accepting all the recommendations made in the office's reports, with the exception of any that might not have been accepted by the audited department or agency. With regards to number two, we do accept this, but it's already really being implemented. The audit committee, which consists of deputy ministers, tracks recommendations using the TAGR system. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It's an acronym, I believe. Number three is where we would like further discussion with the AG, possibly at another time. We're just not sure of the palatability of bringing a deputy minister in and some of the other people mentioned on a yearly basis. And we're certainly open to this idea and the concept, but we don't know if it's really necessarily to have a habitual meeting of sorts with this type of engagement. We're definitely, like I said, we're open to the idea, and I would say just as a comment that we could do this recommendation as an ad hoc basis when you want to have a specific deputy minister in or a specific personnel that we could, the committee is here, and we can certainly approach that way of doing it. Further, that we'd actually like to put a fourth recommendation in to explore. We would like the AG offices to explore the idea of ranking recommendations from the most important, that which should be done immediately, to the items that can wait a little longer to a later date. And perhaps we can discuss this at a future meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin. Would anybody else like to comment? Seeing that there does appear to be support for proposals one and two listed in the letter, could we have a motion that those be accepted by the committee? It's a move by Mr. Rankin. All those in favor? Those opposed? The motion is passed. So we do have an approval that the first two proposals recommended by the Auditor General are accepted. And I think the Auditor General's office will be pleased with that, because those have been with us for some time, and it's nice to have that piece of business progressing along. With that, there was one request for information today by Mr. Stroink, and we will ensure that the clerk of the committee follows up with the department to acquire that information provided to the committee. And with that, we will take a short recess before we move into a briefing for next week's session. Thank you.